hearing on House Bill 5507. Good morning, everyone.
Mr. Chair.
I didn't think you'd be here today.
I'm actually better.
I expected you'd be in the hospital.
No. better living, so I mean, you know, what can you ask for?
On the uphill side.
Yep. Madam Chair and members of the committee, today we're going to have an overview of the workers' compensation system.
Thank you. Good morning. How are you, Debbie? Those used to be stable, huh?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Debbie Lincoln, the Deputy Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. What we'd like to do today is give you an overall description of the workers' compensation system so that we can set the stage for the individual program budgets that you'll be hearing over the next 3 days. I'll be doing the presentation, but we do have in the room the administrators of the three divisions involved, the Workers' Compensation Board. Board Chair is here, Oregon OSHA and the Workers' Compensation Division, so that if you have, program questions, they will be here to answer those.
I may have missed, whereabouts are you in the book? Are you
we are at the Workers' Compensation System tab, which is on page 24.
And what we'll try to do, since we have, you have to be here with us for about 3 weeks, we will try to hold our questions until you're through with this segment, and then if you hesitate, we'll ask the question.
Talk fast. What I'd like to do is describe the funding mechanisms of the system, how they interact, the programs that they fund, the overall impact of the system on Oregon employers and workers, then we can get into individual questions. The purpose, as you know, of the workers' compensation system is to provide a no-fault system based on the principle of exclusive remedy, where both workers and employers have are protected. Workers are assured that any workplace injuries or illnesses are reimbursed, and employers are assured that the workers cannot sue them in court for those injuries. That's the basis of the whole thing. We have a three-way system: insurers, private insurers, Safe Corporation, and self-insured companies provide the insurance for this system. And everyone involved in the system, workers, employers, state government, insurers, have one main goal, and that is to reduce worker injuries. That's the goal that we work toward and the goal that all the partners in the system work toward. We also want to provide appropriate treatment and benefits. That's a very big piece of what we do in the system. And over the last decade, we have reduced litigation, and part of the effort to resolve disputes as quickly as we can, alternative dispute resolution is a big part of that, but the costs of litigation have dropped considerably. Balance and fairness to participants is where we want to get, and very important to us is reducing the cost of regulation and administration, and that's something I think we can give you some evidence of as we go through this. We have a lot of folks involved in this system, so any kind of policy making, funding brings in a number of interest groups, but the one I want to point out particularly is the Management Labor Advisory Committee at the bottom of that page there. This is a 10-member committee, 5 members management, 5 members labor, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, that sits as an advisory group to the director and the governor on workers' compensation issues, and serves as a focal point for input to the system. It grew out of the Mahoney Hall agreements of 1990, where management and labor came together to fix the system. The next page, Mary talked a little bit about the links to Oregon benchmarks yesterday. We do have a big impact on the cost of doing business and creation of new companies. The high cost of workers' compensation in the 80s had a real direct impact on the profitability of businesses in Oregon and the ability to attract business. And the strong economy in Oregon in the past decade is partly due, I think, to the drop in workers' comp costs and the whole overall change of that system. In the decades since the Mahonia-Hall agreements and the 1995-1999 additional reforms, the state has measured a number of indicators to see if the workers' comp system is doing what it should be doing. And the first indicator I want to talk about with you is has to do directly with the number one mission, that is keeping workers from getting hurt or sick on the job. The graph in the middle of page 25 shows the total injury and illness incidence rate and their level, and we've got that up here too. It's easier to read. Have dropped fairly substantially, overall 36% in the last 10 years. And that's from 11 hurt or injured workers per 100 to 7 hurt or injured workers per 100, a fairly good rate. The
10%?
It's dropped 36% since the beginning, since we've counted from 1987 to 1999.
10 or 11?
11, I'm sorry, 11 injured workers per 100 workers overall, and down to 7 per 100 workers. The second indicator is the increased benefit levels. This, of course, is a balancing act. Labor needs to win in this piece. Management needs to win in this piece. Management has seen quite a huge cost decrease over the decade, but workers have benefited as well in that permanent partial disability benefits have increased fairly substantially over that time. And Oregon now ranks about in the middle of the states for benefits, right about where we would like to be. The third indicator is the fact that claims have dropped. The number of accepted disabling claims have dropped 37% since 1987, which is. Which is interesting in that employment grew 44% over that period. So in spite of the fact that we've had an increase in employment, more people working, claims have dropped. One of the questions people ask is, since logging fell off over that decade, is it because work is less hazardous? And that really isn't the case. Construction at the same time boomed, and that is as hazardous as logging, actually. And so the hazard mix has not had much of an impact on that decrease in claim rates. Again, a huge cost driver in any system is litigation, and litigation has dropped off. We used to have 20% of claim closures going to a hearing and eventually to court. We're down to about 5% actually going to hearing. Because we do have a mandatory reconsideration process that the department handles, and we do have an extensive alternative dispute resolution program. Mary mentioned yesterday, our ranking in workers' comp costs has improved significantly over the decade. In the 80s, we were a sixth highest workers' comp cost state in the country. We're now 34th, and again, that's a significant savings to everybody in the system. At the same time, Oregon has proved to be a model of workers' comp reform that many other states have learned from and copied. Page 27, the key issues that we see coming in the next biennium. Senate Bill 485 is moving through the Legislative Assembly. Management Labor Advisory Committee's next package of reforms. Again, this is a balancing act, and the system continually needs tweaking to be kept in balance, and that's what this package of reforms does. It is supported by both management and labor, by the governor, and by the stakeholders involved in pulling it together. We are concentrating in this coming biennium on accessibility to information and using technology to make this system more efficient and more accessible to insurers, to employers, and to workers. And that'll be a big push for us in our budget. We, again, are always looking at how we might reduce costs of regulation administration while continuing to support the mandated legislative programs that are in the law. We do have a fairly rich workers' compensation system. We have, through these reforms, we've developed a number of programs that the legislature and the stakeholders have put in place over the last 10 years, and we do our best to administer those programs at least cost possible. One big issue that's hanging over everyone's head in this system is the pending Supreme Court case, Smothers versus Gresham Transfer. Mr. Smothers was injured on the job. He went through the workers' comp system. His claim was denied because he had a pre-existing condition, and he turned around and sued his employer anyway, which is a challenge, of course, to the exclusive remedy issue, and that is pending in the Supreme Court. It's been heard, and we're waiting for the decision to come down. If the decision comes down that Mr. Smothers can sue his employer, that negates the exclusive remedy, and the whole workers' comp system is turned on its head. So we will be back in special session, probably. But that's a big issue that we're waiting to see the outcome. What I'd like to do, we talked a little bit about this shortfall, and I want to skip that piece right now, go on, describe the rest of the system, and come back to what we're looking at in terms of revenue issues in the coming biennium. If you'll go on to, let's see, 28. I'm sorry, I got too much extra stuff. We'll talk about the funding of the workers' compensation system. What I want to do in this section is talk about the sources of revenue. What they're spent on in state government, and then we'll get to next biennium's budget issues. The workers' compensation system is funded on a three-legged stool setup, the three pieces being the pure premium, or the premium that an employer pays to an insurer for workers' compensation insurance, the premium assessment, which is an assessment that we charge in order to support programs at the state level, and the third piece is called the cents per hour assessment, which is an assessment that both employers and workers pay. The first piece, the workers' compensation premium, goes to insurers to cover employers. The state does not get this premium. However, the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services does have the authority to set the pure premium, that is the base premium cost that all insurers then base their costs on. All insurers take that pure premium cost, add their own additional cost to it, and then charge their customers. So everybody starts out on the same level. That rate-setting process is driven by the economy, by loss rates, by actuarial analyses. It's very technical. We have managed to keep it very non-political over the years, and it forms the basis of the whole workers' compensation system. We are the only state that has seen a drop in pure premium for such an extensive period of time. We have had 11 straight years of pure premium decreases, and we're expecting probably that we'll see another one this summer, though, so anything could happen. What that has done is save employers a great deal of money, over $5.6 billion in the last 10 or 11 years in costs for their insurance. It's a 57% reduction. But that then creates other issues as it interacts with the rest of the system. The second piece of the system is the workers' compensation premium assessment. This is collected from employers by their insurers and then forwarded to the state to support the programs funded by the workers' in the workers' compensation system. current assessment rate is 7.3%. The bottom, the page on the graph on the bottom of the page shows the premium assessment rate and what it has done over the years. As we discussed yesterday, back in the 80s, it spiked up to as high as 16.8%. And that Representative Butler asked what the economy does to the system, and that is one of the things the economy does. That 16.8% spike, you'll notice, is back when we were having major trouble with the economy. In fact, in about 1983, we set the rate in January and it had to come back in July to bump it up again because there simply wasn't enough money coming in.
Excuse me a second, Debbie. Representative Butler.
Two questions. When you came back in July, that's just, you do that under your own authority as the director of insurance for the state, workers' compensation insurance for the state. Number one, and then number two, the 16.8%, which it had previously been years ago, and the 7.3%, that's a tack on to the current total premium. So if the bill is $100, then the full amount is shown as a subtotal below that is $7.30 in effect. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair, Representative Butler. Yes to both questions.
And none of the amount is hidden, such as with our, for instance, the telephone tax, the local telephone tax that can go to cities. Right now, they can charge the city can charge a franchise of as much as 7 cents, but on your bill you can't show more than 4 cents of it. So 100% of that is all visible, so that employers know how much they are paying for the actual workers' compensation system to support the system.
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, yes, that's true. Insurers show that as a separate item on the bill, and I believe we brought in one of SAFE's bills at one time to demonstrate that you can see very clearly that's an assessment. When we bumped it up from 4.5% to 7.3%, it was very clear that employers knew what they were paying and that charge was there. We heard from a number of them.
If I may, Madam Chair, that may be done mid policy at that point. I mean, because it's based upon the needs of the department, and it's my understanding that insurance companies themselves have absolutely no problem with that. As a matter of fact, they appreciate the ability to show the full amount and know that they get value for the money is what I hear back from the insurance industry in the state. Is that generally your feeling?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, yes, it is.
Thank you.
The rate-setting process has in the past been strictly a director process. The director could set that rate. In the last 2 or 3 years, we have put in place at the direction of the legislature an administrative rule process. So now it is part of rulemaking so that it's a public forum that this rate is set in. So if we needed to come back this July and bump that rate up, we'd have to go through an administrative rule process hearing and all the stakeholders would be involved. Everyone would know.
Again.
Mr. Chair, members, also, they are required to, by law, to report to the emergency board annually on their assessment rate.
Thank you, Robin. And I just wanted to make certain that all the members knew that was a very open and above board process. That there's nothing covert nor hidden. It's all done in full public view.
Thank you. Go ahead, Robin.
Madam Chair, Mary, our director, is home with that today. They sound pretty bad. The workers' compensation cents per hour assessment is the third piece of this funding mechanism, and that's on page 29. This assessment generally supports the workers' benefit fund, the fund, as you recall, program put in place to get workers back to work, to pay claims for people who have nowhere else to get their claims paid, that kind of thing. And we'll talk in a minute about what all is in that fund. What happens here is that a certain number of cents for every hour worked is charged, and you'll see it on your pay stub. The employer pays half and the employee pays half. Currently that rate is 3.6 cents per hour. So an employer pays 1.7 and 1.2.
Thank you. Budget, I'm in charge of your budget, aren't you? 1.8 cents per hour, and the worker pays 1.8 cents per hour. And we're, it's projected to hold there through 2002, and we don't foresee any change, probably for another 2 or 3 years after that, though again, anything can happen. In 2000, the rate was 4 cents per hour. You'll see in the chart down there that it was as high as 4.2 cents per hour in the last few years. So we have been able to keep that down and even drop it. This anticipates, this forecast of 3.6 cents per hour anticipates the effect of Senate Bill 485, which does have some effect on the Workers' Benefit Fund, the transfer that we mentioned from the Workers' Benefit Fund to the premium operating account that we are recommending. So we feel we can keep that rate solid in spite of those impacts. The other pieces of the funding mix are relatively small. We do get federal funding from the U.S. Department of Labor for Oregon OSHA programs, and investment income and ending balance are a big piece of this. We do get fines and recovered claim costs, which is a fairly small source of revenue. In the ending balance, I wanted to point out that we did have a high ending balance in the past. It subsidized the rates. That 4.5% assessment rate was subsidized by a high ending balance. The legislature directed us to start spending that down to get it to a maximum of 12 months of expenditures, and we are by statute then directed to keep our ending balance at 12 months of expenditures in order to deal with cash flow and to deal with any sudden changes in the economy, so that that ending balance is no longer available to subsidize the rates, and we have to keep that in mind as we project what kind of rates we need to charge. Going from the funding system to the expenditures part of it, on page 30, the first of the two funds that we have in this system is the one we've been talking about, the premium assessment operating account, funded by the workers' comp premium assessment. We expect to get about $110 million in revenues for that fund overall, and you see there on the pie chart the proportions of the revenues. Again, the assessment is the largest piece of this and has the biggest impact on expenditures. The expenditures.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes,
and the assessment, the workers' compensation premium assessment, is the cents per hour.
It is the assessment that is charged on top of the pure premium.
So that's 7.3%.
Right, right.
And let's see, the cents per hour in that graph, does it
cents per hour is not in this graph, it's in the next one on the next
goes,
page.
It goes into the workers' benefit fund.
Right, right.
Okay. Now, Madam Chair, I am sorry to be so very dense on this, but I just want to know, there's certain things that the Workers' Benefit Fund does as opposed to the Workers' Compensation Premium Assessment Operating Account, and when we start transferring, I no question that you have the authority to do those, but I'd like to just get some sense of the mission of the Premium Assessment Operating Account and the Workers' Benefit Fund, and why it's necessary to why when we overcollect in one place, we have the ability to transfer it back and to make sure that's, again, no question as to the statutory ability to do that. I just would like to have some sense as to why sometime when it gets one gets too much, then we transfer. That's what my wife does with my bank account, and it's really tough to find out that sometimes we come to the end of the month before we come to the end of the paycheck or vice versa. And so I just needed to have some sense as to how that the two missions of the two funds and why when one is over you can transfer and how that works.
And Chair and Representative Butler will document that, I think, pretty carefully.
Okay, fine, I appreciate it.
Representative Hayden?
And when you do, if you do have clear statutory authority, why was a Justice Department opinion sought on that transfer?
You'll get into that?
Thank you, Gift. Actually, the expenditures piece of that, the pie on the bottom shows the expenditures, and if you'll turn to page 31, and you might want to pull out page 33 and take a look at them both at the same time. Page 31 is the premium assessment operating account expenditures, and 33 is the workers' benefit fund expenditures, and you'll see that the different the purposes of both of those. The operating account is for operating costs, administration of the programs in state government. It supports the various divisions, the workers' comp division, Oregon OSHA, the Workers' Compensation Board. It also supports some of the central services that support those divisions, our business administration division, our information management division, and something that isn't there, should be, is the director's office. About 68% of our funding for central services comes from the workers' compensation premium assessment because it's the largest piece of the department. We also have two ombudsmen, one for injured workers and one for small businesses, whose budgets are supported by this account, and a very small piece of the insurance division, it's about $800,000 now, is supported by this assessment for the regulation of workers' comp insurers. So the purpose of the premium assessment operating account is to support the limited budgets of the department. The workers' benefit fund, on the other hand, is the purpose of it is to support those programs that directly affect workers and employers, and to pay out claims for those folks who don't have any other way to get claims paid. The workers' benefit fund programs, handicapped workers program, reopened claims programs, retroactive programs, and on are transfer payments, special payments. So that's the difference between the two funds. One is for the administration of department programs, and it's a limited budget. The other is a non-limited budget that supports transfer payments to workers' comp claimants and to some employers. And those programs are listed there.
May I ask a question relative to the workers' benefit fund then? I noticed in the workers' benefit fund, yeah, you know, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to hold this question until the end of the section, if you'd like.
No, go ahead.
There's in addition to handicapped workers, there's a lot of other kinds of things that we can do there. And so when we over collect in the workers' benefit fund, then we can transfer to the premium assessment operating account. And is that what's being proposed, potentially, this one transfer to pay administrative costs of the workers' benefit fund?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Butler, that's what's being proposed. And let me get a couple handouts to you that further show what
Madam Chair, what I would like to do is I'd like to hold my questions, and I think we're coming on the same line of what,
yeah,
what some of these, the efficacy of each of the various mm-hmm. programs. I assume that you'll get into that, Debbie, what each of the various payments are in addition to the transfers between the accounts.
Okay. Actually, I'm about ready to talk about that transfer now, so we might as well probably go ahead.
I'll try and
Now, is that a different tab?
No, what we're going to work from the sheets that are being handed out right now. What we're proposing to do is to put in place a budget principle that most funds already work by. That is, the administrative costs of a program funded by a certain fund are taken out of that same fund. That has not been the case since the Workers' Benefit Fund started, and I'm afraid I can't tell you why. That was 10 or 12 years ago when all these funds were put together. Up until now, the administrative costs of the reemployment assistance and retroactive programs, all those programs have been funded out of the premium assessment operating account. Supporting those administrative costs out of the Workers' Benefit Fund is a good budget principle and makes sense. The politics around this are that the premium assessment operating account is paid entirely by employers because it's paid through that premium assessment and employers pay that. The Workers' Benefit Fund is jointly supported by both employers and workers through the cents per hour mechanism. So up to now, programs benefiting workers have had their administrative costs supported entirely by employers. So what we think makes more sense, plus fiscally helps us manage these funds, is to move those administrative costs from the employer-supported premium assessment operating account to the workers' benefit fund so that the people who are actually benefiting from that fund are paying both the program costs and the administrative costs. So that's the main reason why we're doing it. This would be a one-time thing. We would not try to bail out the assessment operating account with the workers' benefit fund or vice versa on a regular basis. We're trying to adjust this both to help the assessment operating account, but also because we think it's the right thing to do budgetarily and to get those folks who are benefiting from the program to support the administration of that program.
That's the effect of 485, Senate Bill 485.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, no, 45 does not deal with this. This is something we can do administratively and through the budget process. And what we've given you on the one pager, the total recommended biennial transfer, and we do have $11 million there. Yesterday we said $12 million as we worked through the numbers and reworked through the numbers yesterday. We tweaked that and actually we found something that had been counted annually, which should have been biennial, that kind of thing. So the number that you see here, $11 million, is the number we're recommending. But we've got...
The 12-2.
Exactly, yes, yes. Well, and we will change the pages in your notebook so that won't be confusing. The individual programs that we're recommending to transfer are those that benefit workers. So if you look at the first one, the Reemployment Assistance Program includes the Preferred Worker Program, and a program that gets workers back to the employer where they were injured quickly. The Preferred Worker Program is a direct benefit to workers, so we're recommending that those administrative costs be transferred to the Worker Benefit Fund. The Employer Injury Program is of main benefit to employers, so we're recommending those administrative costs stay with the premium assessment operating account, which employers pay for. So that's the thinking behind which programs are recommended for administrative cost transfer and which are not. Maybe I should stop and take questions about that just to be sure we're all on the same page.
Any questions, Representative Hayden?
Well, I've paid it for 30 or 40 years, but I don't know that it's a breakdown between the cents per hour between the employer and the employee of the 3 cents, 3.6 cents per hour. How does it divide between the employee and employer?
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, half and half. The employer pays half and the employee pays half. So it's equal.
It's the perfect tax. It's the tax. I didn't even know it was there.
There you go. You're just becoming used to it, and that's kind of concerning.
And in response to Representative Butler's question that everybody knows exactly what they're paying, if you looked at your pay stub, you probably would know it's there.
Representative Butler.
Thank you very much. And is this cents per hour what used to be called the Tertiary Injury Fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that's...
Too far back. You were still a gleam in your daddy's eye. Let me ask this question. There is a constitutional issue a legal issue as to why this has to be split 50-50. Now some employers just go ahead and opt. And Representative Hayden, if he ever cut a paycheck for his employees, he just paid it himself, or he'd remember it. because it's a pain to have to calculate, because it's based upon those days that employees show up for work, even your dental assistant that shows up for 2 hours, you still have to pay the 3.6 cents, or if it was back in 1995, it was 1.7 cents that you paid and that you withheld from them. I'm suffering from CRS, and I can't remember stuff. That's my problem. Anyway, there was a legal reason why on this injury fund it had to be half charged to an employer, or it had to be participatory. I shouldn't say half and half. Do you remember what the legal reason was?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, my understanding it was the agreement that came out of the Mahoney Hall discussions
This precedes Mahoney Hall. This goes well behind Mahoney Hall.
I don't remember that. It used to be a cent per day. Is that what you're remembering?
It was a cent per day.
Yeah, rather than a cent per hour. But we'll dig around and see if we can find that. It's not something that I recall.
You probably have staff here who may remember it. They have gray hair like I do. Like I say, you were still too young to probably remember some of those olden times, but there's
a lot of gray hair underneath it.
but there was a reason why it had to be participatory, and I don't know.
We'll find out.
Okay.
We'll find out.
All right. Thank you.
Close to cents per day participatory? I don't think so.
I don't know the cents per day where it was, but the cents per hour has to be, and I don't remember. There was a legal reason. We'll find out. That's probably not germane, but it may affect the reason or the ability to transfer, and I'd like to know if there's equity in that transfer.
Madam Chair, we'll find
out.
Thank
you, Debbie.
Let's see. Actually, we go back then to page 27 and the shortfall, which is what part of what we're talking about here, with the transfer being one of the three ways of dealing with that shortfall. I will mention again that the second way of dealing with that is to raise that assessment from 7.3% to 8%, which we had originally proposed in the governor's recommended budget and was part of our premium assessment announcement last fall, so that the stakeholders have had quite a bit of notice of that. And then the third approach is to reduce program expenditures from the workers' comp division, from Oregon OSHA, and from central services in the amount of $3,475,272. Some of that are the administrative costs of a couple of pieces of the workers' benefit fund, so there's also a $4 million reduction from that fund. That, too, has been taken into account as we project the 3.6 cents in the cents per hour. The last piece, then, is to shift the costs of two staff who have done dispute resolution services in the insurance division, assign them somewhat new duties. That opportunity for ADR is still available, but we will not transfer $200,000 of premium assessment operating money to the insurance division, so that saves us some money there. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's pretty much my testimony. There are a lot of details that I'd be more than happy to answer questions about, go into detail on any of the programs that are funded in the benefit fund or the operating account, or go into more detail on how those two assessments have worked over the years, how we develop them.
Okay, any questions for Debbie? And Representative Hayden.
I'll read through this justice opinion. I haven't got to the executive summary yet. But if you have either statutory or administrative rule authority to effect this transfer without asking, why did you ask?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the statutory authority wasn't as clear as it could have been, and we always are conservative about those kinds of things, particularly when it is something of great deal of interest to our stakeholders. We wanted to be absolutely sure.
Any other questions? Representative Butler.
Madam Chairman, I am so dumb what we're talking about here. I don't even know the questions to ask, so I'd like to start on 27, just to ask a couple of issues regarding, and Debbie, forgive me, please, you may have mentioned, the 485 is the, is basically the MLAC agreement, the Mahoney Hall, or the Management Labor Advisory Committee's recommendation from this past year, from the interim.
That's correct.
Okay, and does it have substantial support and is still alive and is still going strong?
Madam Chair, Senator Butler, yes, it does have support.
So it's likely to become law?
That's our expectation.
Okay, and basically 485 does a combination of several things, and can you tell me where I can see what 485 does, or an executive summary on 485?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, we don't have it because it doesn't have a major budget impact, but John Schultz is here and can answer questions, and then we can also get you a written summary.
Well, there would be no fiscal impact
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the fiscal that we anticipate for the workers' benefit fund ranges, okay, on page 32, it has a wide range. We project anywhere from $2.5 million to $8.6 million. So it's very difficult to say. It depends a little bit on whatever impact it has on pure premium.
$2.5 million to $8.6 million?
That's right.
And where is that on page 32?
Yes, that's just mentioned on page 32. Underneath the expenditures line,
right
above the graph.
And okay, so that would be the projected impact of 485, and that's an increase in the overall assessment. Is that right, or is that in the total payments that wouldn't be a total payment? That's
no,
just assessment.
No.
That's the 7.3% assessment.
No, that's the cent per hour assessment.
That's in the cents per hour.
It's in the workers' benefit fund.
Okay.
Right. And it does not require an increase to cover that because the workers' benefit fund is so large.
Another part of our program this morning, our program agenda this morning, didn't know we had a program, did we? Agenda this morning is John Schultz from the Workers' Comp Division Administrator, and I saw you getting anxious to answer some of the questions Representative Butler has posed. So if you would like to introduce yourself, and then if you'd like to answer those questions and start whatever presentation you have, and we'll go about 15 more minutes, then we'll take a break.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Schultz. I'm the administrator for the Workers' Compensation Division, and I did want to mention that in terms of impact from Senate Bill 485, first of all, we've been working on this for several months, and there's quite a bit of controversy about this, what the impact could be. And so from the division and from the departments, you'll probably be getting wide ranges. It's difficult to predict what hasn't happened yet with new law, and there are some pretty fundamental changes embedded in the bill. One of the things that I did want to bring up is that we do expect that Senate Bill 485 will probably raise lost costs or claims costs to the workers' compensation system. We're projecting that could be somewhere around $10 million annually, although again, we're putting some pretty broad ranges on that. That's the midpoint of our range estimate. And so what impact that may have would be in the pure premium rates that Debbie talked about initially in her presentation. That, of course, might then affect the amount of assessment that we would collect. But all of this we're trying to project out again on things that haven't happened, so we're not very sure about this. The thing we're most sure about is the impact on the worker benefit fund, and we do project that there's going to be somewhere between $2.5 to approximately $8.5 million additional expenditure out of the worker benefit fund because of Senate Bill 485.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so if I understand correctly, then 485 passing, which again is the 2001 Management Labor Advisory Committee's recommendation, that would raise the claims cost to the workers' compensation system statewide. All workers' compensation providers would have additional costs for employee coverage of something in the vicinity of about how many million, 8 to 10 million, did you say?
We've been projecting actually a range of anywhere from just right around a couple of million dollars up to $20 million, and the midpoint that we've been sharing is somewhere around $10 million. Or another way to look at that is 1.5 to perhaps 2% increase in pure premium impact.
Okay, 1.5 to 2%. That's what that's equivalent to.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, yes. That's our projection. Now, other people have other projections, and you'll hear different projections probably during the debate.
And then let me ask this. I guess I can say sophomore-ish because Representative Johnson says freshman, bless her heart. But this is really a sophomore-ish kind of question. But as we get a 1.5 to 2%. And let's say that amounts to $10 million in pure premium, then the premium assessment operating account would benefit from that to the tune of 7.3%, and you're talking about moving that up to 8%. If we've got 7.3% more of, or 7.3% of a greater number, why would we move that up to 8%? What's the additional I'm going to buy the acronym NLAC. I'm going to have to do that.
You can pay later. We'll just charge in.
Oh yeah.
Representative Butler, I'll do it for you because we want to use it too.
Okay. So the NLAC comes back and says, well, we'll put 485 through, and that's good for employers, it's good for employees, and it's good for the state and injured workers and those folks. And so we're going to go ahead and run it through, and then we get a pure premium. The insurance carriers in the state kick up premiums by 1.5 to 2%, and that's, I recognize, John, that might be all over the board. But why is there a commensurate increase with the new $10 million that we're going to collect, and we're going to collect 7.3% of $10 million more, and then we might have to run and if that's a 2% increase, and that 2% amounts to $20 million, then the total premiums must be somewhere in the vicinity of about $100 million a year, or is it more than that?
$600 million
per year premiums, and so if that went up 2%, then that would be to $630 million or something like that.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, you're absolutely right, and I think you've caught the issue in terms of the interaction of these two things. If pure premium were to be bumped up substantially enough to make a difference in what we're collecting on assessment, and we wouldn't assess the whole 8%. We would assess whatever percentage gave us what we needed to run the programs. We bring the 8% as kind of a maximum. It's the maximum agreed on with the stakeholders, and we've got it. We're proposing that now based on the forecast that we've got right now. If your premium didn't drop this summer, went up instead, or even didn't drop as much as we think it might, we wouldn't bump the assessment up as high as 8%. We would lower that projection based on what actual revenue we need. The point is to get the amount of money necessary to support the programs. We don't want to get extra. So if the assessment costs if the assessment is too high, if the 8% isn't necessary, we won't go up that high. And that'll depend on the whole process to determine the pure premium starts actually about now with the National Council of Compensation Insurers beginning to do its actuarial studies. And we work through the summer with the actuaries and the professionals who do those kinds of things. And by August, we determine what the pure premium should be for the following calendar year, and then we figure out, given that base, and given the legislatively approved budget, what revenues we need, and then we determine the assessment. So if that pure premium goes up this summer, we can keep the assessment flat, drop it, whatever it is we need to do.
Madam Chair, I'm coming up with more questions than I'm really. The answers are making more questions, but the insurance division assists in setting those premiums, do they not? Joe Ariel?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the insurance division's actuary, Rick Elliott, who is our forecaster, is in the room. He helps. And then we have an outside national company who does this from many states
It's not done in the vacuum. We actually assist in it and help establish that rate. So it's not like it's an unknown, because I've heard just in the last couple of minutes that it could go up from 1.5% to 2%, and then you said something about it going down.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, as we've shown you, it's gone down over the last 11 years. It could go down again, but not as much as it would have had 485 not been in place.
I see. So if it continues to go down, then the premium assessment operating account would suffer, and then the 7.3 wouldn't be enough, but it could raise up to a maximum of 8. And so with the premiums coming down, and we'd need up to 8% in order to carry out the functions of the premium assessment account, operating account.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I'm sorry, because yeah. The testimony had been it could go up 1.5% to 2%, and visiting with Ms. Keene from State Action Industrial Fund, her comment was chances are they will likely go up. And I haven't talked to your actuaries or anything. And if they're likely to go up, then I couldn't understand why we'd be going from 7.3 as the assessment to as much as 8% with the pure premiums going out. So thank you. I think that explains that portion.
Any other questions for Representative?
Coming back to page 25 and 26, when you said that there were 10 injured. I heard you say 10 injured workers per 100, and I thought that was a shocking figure, like a Siberian coal mine or something. But I see what you were referring to is a graph called total cases of injury and illness, and that would include the flu and childbirth, and it does not.
No.
For disabling injury?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the illnesses would be work caused illness, asbestosis, for example. So they have to be work-related to be counted in here. And yes, back in the late 80s, we were seeing as many as 11 out of every 100 injured workers getting hurt or sick on the job. And that it was.
And yet you have a graph on page 26 that says that only the claim rate is 1.6. So how are you tracking 10 lost days, or 10% of the workers being injured or losing time, and only 1% filing a claim?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, these are disabling claims on 26. Those are claims that actually disable a worker for a certain period of time. On page 25, those claims.
Top graph on 26.
Yes.
Is disabling?
Is disabling claims. Accepted disabling claims.
And the others are just lost time, and then they go back to work.
They're either lost time, or they're simply injuries on the job that were reported, never claimed, or weren't accepted in the workers' comp system.
I just find that astonishingly high, Madam Chair.
But it's still not 11 per 100. It's 11 per 1,000, is it not?
No, it was 11 per 100. We're down to 7 per 100 now.
That is 11 per 100, but it includes illness. It includes lost time for because you have the flu and the
No, it's just job-related. Only job-related illness.
Only if you got the flu on the job.
Well,
no. Can you give me some examples?
Asbestosis is the one that comes to mind. It has to be an illness that is created because you were in a job situation. What else?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, again, John Schultz with Workers' Compensation Division. And asbestosis is a good example of an occupational illness. Correct.
That's so rare.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, that's correct. Other examples of occupational disease are, are other respiratory illnesses that somebody might pick up on the job. For example, this Smothers case that was discussed earlier, the Supreme Court case, that is an occupational disease case where a worker inhaled acid fumes on the job and did file an occupational disease claim, or an illness claim, as it's noted here. Occupational disease claims are rare in the system, quite frankly. Most of the claims are injuries. Occupational disease claims only make up a couple of percent of the overall claims that are filed in the workers' compensation system. And if I may, to point out again the difference in the graphs on page 25, these are total cases of injury and illness incident rates that are collected, if I think I'm correct on this, primarily by Oregon OSHA on their in their tracking systems. What you see on page 26 are the actual accepted disabling claims in the workers' compensation system. There are more claims that are filed in the workers' compensation system that are disabling but are denied. They're not accepted claims. They don't show up here. So that might explain some of the difference. It's not all because of denial. Again, Debbie explained some of these are of the claims that, the incident rate shown on page 25 relates to people who just had first aid or perhaps lost a day. In the workers' compensation system, you have to miss at least 3 days from work before your claim is considered a time loss claim or disabling.
Madam Chair, I presume I'm interested in this because of my background in public health, and I never heard a figure like that in my years of study. And if it wouldn't be a whole lot of trouble, if I could just have a very brief memo on the kinds of occupational illnesses, not injuries, occupational illnesses that result in lost time that would be reported in this graph. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Dukes?
And I'm interested if the disease claims are increasing, things like carpal tunnel, eye strain, those sorts of things as we move into a more technology-based. It seems like we started out where people spent a lot of time in one place, in manufacturing, and we've graduated out of that, and now I think we're getting back into it again. And you hear a lot about those, but I'd be curious as to how they're reflecting. Are your disease rates claims filed increasing over where they were before?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, I believe they are, but I would like to be able to come in and provide the actual numbers, if I may.
Thank you. And I think we'll go ahead and take a break now, and then I'll come back and begin your presentation. Take a 5-minute break.